The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford, doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where Were You in 92 is a production of iHeartRadio. A special note: this episode contains themes of physical and sexual abuse and may not be suitable for all listeners.
She looked like someone who was going into battle. Never has Sinead looked as much like, you know, what I imagine Joan of Arc looking like. You know, she knew exactly what she intended to do. Did she know what the ramifications were? No. But she definitely knew what she wanted to do the minute she started singing that song.
Welcome to Where Were You in 92, a podcast in which I, your host, Jason Lanfier, look back at the major hits, one-hit wonders, shocking news stories, and irresistible scandals that shaped what might be the wildest, most eclectic, most controversial 12 months of music ever. This week, after scoring a number one smash with her version of the Prince song, Nothing Compares to You, Irish singer-songwriter Sinead O'Connor became an international sensation. While her look, a shaved head and dazzling doe-like eyes, was arresting, her gale-force vocals were next level. A songbird and a siren, she could pivot from a whisper to a scream in seconds. But if her stars seemed to rise overnight, it fell just as quickly. In October of 1992, less than 2 weeks after releasing her new album, Am I Not Your Girl, O'Connor concluded her performance on Saturday Night Live by ripping up a photo of Pope John Paul II to protest the Catholic Church concealing acts of child abuse. The incident sparked rabid backlash, with radio stations refusing to play her music and audiences boycotting her. One single gesture torpedoed her career. In this episode, we examine the events leading up to that fateful evening, its crushing consequences, O'Connor's complicated relationship with fame, and how many of her critics realized years later that she was right all along. Plus, director Katherine Ferguson joins us to discuss her award-winning 2022 documentary, Nothing Compares, which traces the singer's life, exile, and legacy. When I look back at the artists who've been instrumental in shaping who I am today, so many of them confused me when I first heard or saw them. I found them weird and hard to pin down, and therefore off-putting. They made me uncomfortable, sometimes even scared me. They were disruptors of gender or genre, and often both, blurring the lines between male and female, pop and performance art. Nina Simone, David Bowie, Kate Bush, Prince, Bjork, Anoni, Sinead O'Connor. I can't tell you where I was when I first heard Sinead O'Connor. I was too young to really absorb my surroundings, for sound and time and place to coalesce into a major musical moment. But I remember that voice. It had nothing to do with my being American and her being Irish. I had no idea where she'd come from. I remember that voice because it yanked me by the collar and pulled me out of my comfort zone. It was big and beautiful, but also strange and intimidating, a little chilling. Music journalist and critic Ann Powers had a similar reaction when hearing O'Connor for the first time in the 1980s, when Troy, a highlight from the singer's 1987 debut album The Lion and the Cobra, suddenly burst through the speakers in her room. Her encounter with that voice made her an instant fan.
I will never forget lying in bed in my San Francisco apartment, listening to KUSF, the local college radio station, and the song Troy came on. And I mean, the story in that song is so compelling, but the voice, just the voice itself, the power, the rage, the vulnerability, the purity and the dirt in it, all of that, it just slew me to my soul. And I, from that moment, my undivided love for Sinead was born.
Powers was a young Irish-American woman who had been raised to be aware of her heritage. She'd been served a lot of popular culture about Ireland and about the Troubles, the 30-year conflict in Northern Ireland between Protestant Unionists, or Loyalists, who wanted it to remain part of the United Kingdom, and Roman Catholic Nationalists, or Republicans, who wanted it to become part of the Republic of Ireland. Powers had movies, TV, and the band U2 representing her past and present. But O'Connor folded in Irish folk music and classic Seanos folk singing that truly resonated with her. Across the Atlantic, director Catherine Ferguson, who was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland's capital, was having a similar response to the singer. She thanks her father for exposing her to O'Connor's music.
There was just nothing like her. She was like an alien from outer space. And she just seemed so thrilling, really, to me at that point. She was put in front of me, this incredible example of, you know, this incredible, iconic character to admire. So, it all began then.
I was way too young to be cool enough to know O'Connor's acclaimed first album, The Lion and the Cobra. But for a certain period, hearing her 1990 cover of Prince's Nothing Compares To on your radio was a given, as predictable as the sun coming up each day and going down at the end of it, which is what the song, the ultimate breakup anthem, sounds like. It is somehow both bracing, like the first breath you take stepping out into the morning, and definitive, like the brightness vanishing and the darkness of evening descending. Its most memorable line is its most quietly devastating. All the flowers that you planted, Mama, in the backyard, all died when you went away. That's it. So succinct, yet so rich and vivid. You hear it, and you're watching those flowers wilt. But it's more than that. You're there, with a split screen in front of you. On screen one, those flowers dying under the winter frost. On screen two, O'Connor's lover crossing the threshold, last box in their arms, walking away from her and her mother and her family and everything they've established, a foundation crumbling. Yes, we must credit the Purple One with writing that line. But let's also be real here. O'Connor gave it depth. She sings about those flowers and you believe her. Have you heard Prince's version of Nothing Compares To You? He wrote it for his side project, The Family, and it appeared on their eponymous 1985 debut album. It's good. Better than good. It certainly does the job. But this song belongs to Sinead. And it's because of that voice, which conveys years of hurt, confusion, longing, and hope, and does so like it's effortless. Says Ferguson.
But her voice seemed to have such a global appeal that it seemed to break through where others hadn't. And I think that went a very long way for Sinead. I think really her talent was so startling that it just went through boundaries. It just pushed through.
O'Connor's rousing interpretation of Nothing Compares To You made her a star, a huge worldwide star. The track soared to number one in the UK, Ireland, Australia, Canada, Germany, Mexico, New Zealand, Sweden, Switzerland, and the US, where it stayed at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 for 4 weeks. On the second week of its reign at number one, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, the album it appeared on, began its six-week run at number one on the Billboard 200. Billboard would name Nothing Compares To You the number one world single at the end of 1990. The song was everywhere, and O'Connor's angelic face and her pained expression in its music video was all over MTV, where Nothing Compares To You became a staple soon after its release. It's easy to see why. Directed by John Mabry, it features the singer walking through Paris's Parc de Saint-Cloud on a frigid day. Dressed in a cloak, She looks monastic as she contemplates her sorrow and regret. But it's the video's close-up shots of O'Connor, in which tears stream down her cheeks, that made it legendary. Says Ann Powers,
she gazes outward directly into the eye of the viewer, and her, all of the qualities that we associate with Sinead, her beauty, her vulnerability, her fierceness, are all in that gaze and in that vocal performance.
When she looks at you in that video, you absorb both her strength and her defenselessness in the wake of her heartbreak. Her exposing that heartbreak and defenselessness, placing it in sharp relief against a stark black backdrop, is why she comes across so strong, so resilient. And this is largely because the tears she sheds are real tears. You see, Prince's line about the narrator's mother's flowers dying took on a new meaning for O'Connor when she shot the video for Nothing Compares to You. Delivering it, she could not help but think of her own mother, who had died in a car accident a few years before. As she recalled in Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks' 2011 book, I Want My MTV, The Uncensored Story of the Music Video Revolution, quote, I made an emotional connection, which I was not expecting. It didn't hit me when I was recording the song. It only kicked in when I was being filmed. So I was sitting there, thinking about me mother, and trying hard not to bawl my eyes out. I had one little tear. That became the whole video. But it wasn't supposed to be. The video was massive, and it changed my career. It did. Nothing Compares to You won Video of the Year at the 1990 Video Music Awards, making O'Connor the first woman ever to win in that category. She beat out Madonna's Vogue for the prize. She also took home Moon Men for Best Female Video, also beating out Vogue, and Best Postmodern Video, a category that would be renamed Best Alternative Video the following year. The song and video made her a household name. If she didn't look like other female pop stars of the era, few could argue with the gorgeousness of her voice or the captivating rawness of her video's imagery. O'Connor's grief over the loss of her mother may have pervaded the video for Nothing Compares to You, but the relationship was fraught. She writes in her 2021 memoir, Rememberings, of the abuse she suffered as a child at the hands of her mother, whom she recalls would beat her with her field hockey stick or a carpet sweeper pole. Forcing her to strip naked, she would hit her with the sweeping brush and make her repeat, I am nothing. She also writes that her mother would lock her in her room or under the stairs and starve her, and that she once purposely crashed her car with Sinead in the passenger seat when Sinead's older brother Joe ran away and refused to come home. Her mother was hospitalized. She eventually lost custody of Sinead and her siblings. Sinead's youngest brother, John, stayed with his mother until a second crash. He was in the back seat of the car when it happened, but he survived. He was 16 when his mother died. Sinead was 18. Her mother left four children behind. That was in 1985. In Rememberings, O'Connor describes the bewilderment and anger she felt after her mother's death. She recounts screaming into the sky at God, running from the funeral home. I don't think I'll ever stop running, she writes. She vows to smoke herself into oblivion, to smoke until she too is dead and can reunite with her mother, as chaotic and abusive as the relationship had been. Later that same year, O'Connor left for London because she had landed a record contract with the label Ensign. But she couldn't escape the pain and trauma. It would permeate so much of her work, but also put a fire in her belly. She would become more than just a compelling performer. She would become a crusader. Up next, after the break, we discuss Sinead O'Connor's critically hailed first two albums, The Lion and the Cobra and I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, her first big public act of protest at the 1989 Grammy Awards, and her controversial reaction to her sudden newfound fame.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was the late 1980s. Sinead O'Connor had landed her first record contract, but she was barely an adult. She signed the contract, agreeing to earn a mere 7% of what her record sold, and to pay for nearly all the recording, promoting, and touring out of that 7%. She didn't know any better. Paperwork bored her. One demo she wrote that would end up on her 1987 debut album, The Lion and the Cobra, was Troy, one of the tensest, most searing, most brain-tingling tracks to come out of the 80s, and the first time O'Connor had sung about her mother. But it wasn't just about her mother. Like most songs, it was also about love and heartbreak. A palpable heartbreak. When O'Connor unleashes, roars its most memorable line, I'd kill a dragon for you, I'll die. It genuinely sounds medieval, savage, and terrifying. She is your valiant knight, sword in hand, ready to slay the beast. But she is also the knight, a black, cold, lonely, desperate void longing to be filled. And she is the beast itself, menacing and engulfed in its own flames. You can hear her battered and shattered history, the torment and the fury, all that she's endured before the age of 20. Troy possesses the same dichotomy you hear in Nothing Compares to You. It swerves from delicate to defiant in an instant. That dichotomy, that clashing of tender vulnerability and steadfast resistance would define O'Connor's career. After her turbulent childhood and adolescence, she had little patience for those who wished to control her. Any whiff of bullshit, sexism, misogyny, homophobia, exploitation, abuse, or hypocrisy, and her guard immediately came up. Ann Powers remembers attending one of O'Connor's early press events. She was immediately moved by her poise and candor.
That vibe you get from a young person who is unafraid of everything and yet aware of every ghost and demon in the room. And that is what Sinead was from the beginning. She was not callous. She didn't have that kind of attitude that a lot of male punks did who I encountered in the scene. You know, she was open, but she was also just absolutely determined to make the moves she wanted to make.
Over lunch one day, a pair of record execs at her label told O'Connor they'd like her to stop cutting her hair short and wear short skirts and jewelry to essentially present more like a quote-unquote girl. She responded by buzzing all her hair off. As she recalled in I Want My MTV, quote, "They described their mistresses to me and said I should look like that. I didn't want to be pushed as some kind of pretty girl, so my way of answering was to shave my head. I didn't want to be governed by a load of middle-aged blokes." Her appearance was striking and unconventional for a young female singer in the late 1980s and early 90s. MTV dug it, but not everyone. O'Connor told Spin magazine in 1991 that Madonna said she looked, quote, "like I had a run-in with a lawnmower and that I was about as sexy as a Venetian blind." She scoffed at the idea that Madonna was seen as a sort of feminist hero when she was cutting other women down like that. During production for The Lion and the Cobra, O'Connor discovered she was pregnant. When a doctor relayed to her that her label did not think she should keep the baby after it had spent so much money on the album, she was offended and incensed. She not only kept her baby, but scrapped the record, which she was hating anyway, and decided to start again. Though she didn't really know how to use studio equipment, she would produce it herself. She learned quickly, and the gambit paid off. Rarely do debut albums sound as confident, fearless, and fully formed as The Lion and the Cobra, a work that heralded the arrival of a genuine artist with a genuine vision. O'Connor was just shy of 21 when it came out. The Lion and the Cobra is widely considered one of the best albums of the 1980s and one of the best debut albums of any decade. It eventually went gold and earned O'Connor a Grammy nomination for Best Female Rock Vocal Performance. She performed her college radio hit, Mandinka, at the 1989 ceremony in a head-turning ensemble, a black halter top that revealed her midriff, torn baggy blue jeans, and her signature Doc Martens. She tucked the sleeves of her new son Jake's onesie through her belt loops and wore it around her waist, a sly fuck you to the label who'd essentially asked her not to have him. She also boasted an image of a man in the crosshairs of a gun shaved and dyed on the side of her head. The design was the hip-hop group Public Enemy's logo, meant to symbolize the plight of the black man in America. O'Connor wore it out of solidarity, to support them and other rappers whose music had been excluded from the show. While the Recording Academy had decided to recognize hip-hop with its first ever award for Best Rap Performance, it would not announce the winner and present the award on television. O'Connor's styling was political, an act of protest. Audiences who'd been unfamiliar with her were intrigued, mystified. "I don't know no shame," she wails in Mandinka. The Grammy's performance made you believe it. O'Connor's outspokenness and rebellious streak would not diminish as her star rose. After Nothing Compares to You conquered MTV, and her second album, 1990's I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, went multi-platinum, she could have set aside her politics to avoid courting controversy and focus on her career. But as she makes clear in her memoir, Rememberings, and in Katherine Ferguson's documentary, Nothing Compares, the singer was never interested in becoming an international celebrity. She had punk roots and a punk sensibility. Says Ferguson,
"I just don't think she had ever set out to be a pop star. That wasn't her goal. You know, she was a very serious musician who happened to become a global phenomenon. And I think she didn't go into it ever wanting that. She didn't want to be pigeonholed or have the life that was being created for her."
Some would say O'Connor could write the book on how to derail a pop career. She refused to comply when faced with anything that did not align with her belief system and racked up plenty of enemies along the way. She pulled out of a Saturday Night Live appearance when she learned that Andrew Dice Clay, a comedian known for his homophobic and misogynist sets, was the host. He responded with a skit mocking the quote-unquote bald chick. When O'Connor said she'd prefer that the Star Spangled Banner not be played before her show at Garden State Arts Center in New Jersey, it caused a national uproar, with many calling her quote-unquote anti-American. Politicians protested her. Radio stations refused to play her music. Rapper MC Hammer sent her a check for a ticket back to Ireland. Frank Sinatra said she must be, quote unquote, one stupid broad and threatened to, quote unquote, kick her ass if she were a guy. She skipped the 1991 Grammys and refused to accept her award for Best Alternative Music Performance, writing a letter to the Recording Academy accusing it of favoring materialism over songwriting. In fact, she declined all the awards she received for I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. O'Connor explains her choice and rememberings, writing, quote, "Commercial success outranked artistic merit. I made a lot of money for a lot of men who couldn't actually have cared less what the songs were about." She went on, "I'm a punk, not a pop star," adding, "Music shouldn't be such a competition." Her critics deemed her ungrateful. After the Grammys that year, she left Los Angeles to return to the UK, giving her house to the Red Cross. Whether O'Connor wanted to be a pop star or not, she was. And pop stars with number one hits and big awards rarely ruffled feathers like this. She was right. The stuff she was doing was what punks did, mostly male punks. In the early 90s, she was a young 20-something woman in a male-dominated industry that was still new to her. Says music journalist Dan Powers,
"I don't think she was sacrificed, but I do think she was out there on the bow of the ship before this happened to a lot of other people, and didn't have a lot of guidance and didn't have a lot of examples of how to negotiate this successfully."
On the strength of the success of Nothing Compares to You, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got went to number one in multiple countries, including O'Connor's home country of Ireland. But rather than maintain that upward trajectory and release a more pop-inflected follow-up, she took a sharp left turn. Her next record, 1992's Am I Not Your Girl, wasn't pop at all. It wasn't punk or really folk either. It was a collection of covers of show tunes and jazz standards her parents had played while she was growing up, music that inspired her to pursue a singing career. In her memoir, O'Connor admits that Am I Not Your Girl was a quote-unquote red herring. She didn't want to deal with the anxiety of delivering another I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. She didn't want to deal with the anxiety of being a pop star, period. As Nothing Compares director Catherine Ferguson hypothesizes, O'Connor's about-face may have stemmed from her desire to come up for air after releasing two albums of heavy, intimate material.
But as she says in the film, I think she was buying herself time to work out her next album. But these were all tracks that she really loved, and a lot of them she'd been introduced to as a child. She'd been told that the previous album was like reading somebody's diary, and it was far too personal. So maybe there was this was a bit of light relief for her.
If it was light or fair for her, O'Connor still attached profound meaning to these songs. She included the folk ballad Scarlet Ribbons because her father used to sing it to her when she was a little girl. She chose to cover Evita's Don't Cry For Me Argentina because her mother loved it. Still, a lauded, award-winning, chart-topping pop breakout pivoting to a jazz album right after she'd become one of the most famous singers in the world? O'Connor's decision was super risky and baffling, particularly in the fall of 1992, when grunge, gangster rap, Eurodance, and swoony R&B were dominating the charts. It seemed hopelessly uncool. Says Ann Powers,
"There's a lot of pathos in this track listing, and there's a lot of pathos in her performances. As a career move, it was suicidal. I mean, it was absolutely walking away from the momentum that she had."
In a sense, O'Connor abandoning pop for a standards album was one of the most punk things she could have done.
It's one of those bold moves that seems incredibly foolish, but in the context of her whole career, makes total sense. It's like early on, she's saying, "You cannot control me. And if this sacrifice leads me away from the kind of mainstream career the music industry wants me to have, I'll deal with that."
Am I Not Your Girl is a sleepy listen. It's pretty, but it just doesn't showcase O'Connor's incredible voice enough. Compared to the blazing richness of her first two records, it's tepid. But at certain moments, it soars. With all due respect to Patti LuPone, O'Connor's interpretation of Don't Cry For Me Argentina is unsurpassed. Tim Rice, who wrote its lyrics, agrees. He mailed O'Connor a letter after hearing it, saying it was the best version he'd heard, hands down. "And as for fortune and as for fame, I never invited them in. Though it seemed to the world they were all I desired, they are illusions. They're not the solutions they promised to be. It's hard to listen to those lines from the song without thinking of O'Connor's own dilemma at the time. Same goes for the album's other highlight, Success Has Made a Failure of Our Home, which she admits in her memoir was autobiographical, a nod to her struggle with the trappings of her own newfound success. In the liner notes of Am I Not Your Girl, O'Connor addresses child abuse and its consequences, the death of self-esteem, fear, addiction. We have not been told the truth, she writes. The message is love. What can save us? She titled her musings, Où est le roi perdu? Or Where is the Lost King? Adding, if you're out there, I want to see you. Turns out, the songs were more than just jazz remakes. Her personal trauma and her protest against abuse of any kind suffused the songs. Says Powers,
it was a very unexpected move for an artist like this, especially following up, you know, her massive pop success. And through that project, she was, you know, reaching back into her own childhood and confronting the violence that had been part of her upbringing, and starting to really, I think, grapple with the legacies of exploitation of children and violence toward children that would then motivate her to make a career-changing move.
Up next, after the break, we explore that career-changing move, O'Connor's controversial, scandalous performance on Saturday Night Live, during which she tore up a photo of the Pope and told viewers to quote-unquote, fight the real enemy.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The year was 1992. Sinead O'Connor was living in New York City and was set to promote her latest album, Am I Not Your Girl, which was released in September. But the singer had other things on her mind. As she noted in the liner notes of the record, she had turned her attention to the tense social climate, specifically to news of child abuse and the fight for abortion rights. Says Katherine Ferguson, director of the 2022 Sinead O'Connor documentary, Nothing Compares.
She had been reading about the cover-up of abuse in Ireland and families being silenced. And I think she was just really enraged by the hypocrisy and felt compelled to take a stand. And I think, you know, 1992 in Ireland was a pretty tumultuous time. The Troubles were still awful in the north and the south. And of course, the question of women's bodily autonomy was really back in the news. In the south of Ireland, there was a very famous case called the X case, where a young 14-year-old had been raped and her family had taken her to England for an abortion. But then the Irish police, the guards, while she was in England, they were alerted to an injunction ordering them to come home. You know, this had kick-started a huge swathe of protests and uproar and a lot around Catholicism and the control in the church. And Sinead was even, in 92, she'd actually appeared at one of these big pro-choice rallies in Dublin. She'd been reading about these cases and thinking about it. And I suppose when you look back at what she endured as a child and as a teenager, it just all kind of came full circle.
As O'Connor recalls in her memoir, when her mother died, she returned to her home for the first time in a long time. The only photo in her mother's room, the only photo she remembers her ever having in her room, was of Pope John Paul II visiting Ireland in 1979. She writes of the photo, "It represented lies and liars and abuse. The type of people who kept these things were devils like my mother. I never knew when or where or how I would destroy it. But destroy it I would when the right moment came." She kept the photo every time she moved, says Ferguson.
I just think this picture on the wall of her mother's bedroom was very potent.
While in New York, O'Connor met Terry, a West Indian Rastafarian man from St. Lucia who worked at a juice bar, which was really a front for him and his friends to sell weed. One night, just before she would appear as a musical guest on Saturday Night Live, Terry revealed to her that he'd been using children as drug mules, running guns and drugs in their book bags. He'd invaded someone's turf, and his life was now in danger. O'Connor was shocked, livid, distraught. She saw him the Friday night before her SNL set, and that would be the last time she ever saw him. The newspaper stories of children being abused by priests and their parents having their stories suppressed and silenced were weighing on O'Connor. She was angry, even angrier knowing that her friend Terry had also been abusing children. Was it time to exhume her mother's photo? Was it time to break the silence? For her first number on the October 3rd episode of Saturday Night Live in 1992, O'Connor performed Success Has Made a Failure of Our Home. Pointed, apt. For her second number, she was supposed to perform Bob Marley's War a cappella, a song about how racism is the root of all fighting and bloodshed, and hold up a photograph of a Brazilian child killed by police as the camera zoomed in. O'Connor surrounded herself with candles. She wore a white lace dress that had previously belonged to Sade that she'd bought at an auction at 19. She also wore a Star of David necklace and draped a Rasta prayer cloth over the microphone. She delivered the song's final line, "We have confidence in the victory of good over evil." But when she reached the word evil, she revealed a different photograph, her mother's picture of Pope John Paul II. "Fight the real enemy," O'Connor shouted. She ripped the photo in half one time, two times, three times, before throwing its pieces toward the camera. Watch the moment on YouTube, and you can hear only the sound of tearing and a single male voice seemingly an audience member, emitting a shocked whoa. No applause. O'Connor takes out her earplugs and blows out the candles. She recalls walking backstage to close the doors. Cast, crew, her manager had disappeared. Everyone had abandoned her, except her personal assistant, who helped her pack up and leave. News of O'Connor's SNL performance broke immediately. Throughout Sunday and Monday, NBC reportedly received more than 4,000 calls from outraged viewers. She was banned from the show for life. Says Ferguson.
I just don't know if people even knew what they just seen at the time. They just probably couldn't even comprehend what on earth it was.
Music journalist Ann Powers has vivid memories of watching the Saturday Night Live performance in real time that evening. She, like everyone else, was stunned. But she could see the resolve on O'Connor's face.
But she looked like someone who was going into battle. Never has Sinead looked as much like, you know, what I imagine Joan of Arc looking like, you know, just complete absorption in her intention, her action. At the time, people were like, what did, was she really meaning to do what she did? But I could see it in her eyes. She knew exactly what she intended to do. Did she know what the ramifications were? No. But she definitely knew what she wanted to do the minute she started singing that song.
As an Irish-American woman who grew up Catholic and felt the strict, heavy-handed rule of the church, Powers championed O'Connor's stand against its transgressions and hypocrisy.
Anyone raised Catholic or in a Catholic-dominated culture knows how what a strong hold that ideology can have on a person. So for me, it was incredibly cathartic.
More repercussions came instantly, and they were enormous. With one simple act, O'Connor had detonated her career, at least her career as a famous pop artist. No, she never really wanted that career, but she also could never have predicted the severity of the fallout after the Notorious performance. Says Ferguson.
Even a star, which she was, like one of the biggest musicians in the world in 1992, literally probably the top three female artists in the world, she wasn't untouchable, and she suffered the consequences for using her platform and speaking out. You know, there were steamrollers rolling over her records in Times Square. There were death threats to her management and to her and her family. Lots of radios refused to play her music. You know, the tabloid press had a field day.
Before the SNL incident, O'Connor had been invited to perform at a Bob Dylan tribute concert at New York's Madison Square Garden. Given that he was one of her idols and biggest influences, she was over the moon. This was an advantage of being famous she could fully support, the chance of a lifetime. Just a couple of weeks had passed since she'd torn up the photo of the Pope. It was fresh in the audience's minds as she took to the stage to perform a cover of Dylan's I Believe in You. The sound that ensued was horrifying, an excruciating cacophony of boos and cheers, all-encompassing to the point that O'Connor could not sing. She describes it in Rememberings as, quote-unquote, a sonic riot, as if the sky is ripping apart. She stood, mortified and paralyzed, her dreams shattering before her eyes. She began to pace, afraid of being drowned out, but also of doing nothing and letting her hecklers win.
She tells her band to stop playing the music. She takes her headphones out. So I imagine people are telling her, asking, I'm sure she's getting a lot of people in her ear, saying, what are you doing? She rips them out of her ears and she just starts to sing Bob Marley's War again, but a much more furious version at this audience of 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden, and just screams the words over the crowd. But really, it's a harrowing watch. I mean, it's such a harrowing watch because she's just horrified by the response she gets. And, you know, this is after 2 weeks of backlash that she's had all over the world.
Country singer Kris Kristofferson joined her on stage, leaning in and telling her, don't let the bastards get you down. They exited. He hugged her. O'Connor recalls nearly throwing up on him. Later, she went to Dylan's manager to ask him and the singer to help her expose the child abuse at the hands of the Irish church. He refused. After the Madison Square Garden show, her father suggested that she abandon music and go back to school. Some have called O'Connor's SNL set an act of performance art. She didn't explain herself. And afterwards, her many critics didn't want an explanation. They didn't understand and didn't care to. She was on her own, a solitary crusader. Fame was lonely. Activism was even lonelier. Suzanne Powers.
That's an interesting thing about her fame in general. Because when you think of the apex of her success, that video for Nothing Compares to You, it's just her. You know, you never see a band. You don't see her collaborators. It's just her. And when you think of that moment on Saturday Night Live again, it's just, even though there was a band, it's just her. You only think about her. And then when you think of her getting booed off the stage at the Dylan thing again, she is always like alone. And that speaks so profoundly to the predicament of women in music and in rock, especially at that time.
O'Connor would continue to release albums, beautiful ones. Her follow-up to Am I Not Your Girl, 1994's Universal Mother, offered some of her most personal work yet. It's gorgeous and brutal. She'd dabble in traditional Irish folk, reggae, rock, spiritual music, and even pop. But her provocative SNL performance cast a long shadow over her career and did a number on her mental health. As she said in a 2021 interview with Entertainment Weekly, quote, "The 10 years after that Saturday Night Live performance, the way that I was dealt with was shocking. It was the fashion to treat me bad, whether you were in my bed, at a board meeting, a TV show, a gig, or a party. Everybody treated me like I was a crazy bitch because I ripped up the Pope's picture. We know I'm a crazy bitch, but that's not why," says Ferguson.
I think not having the number ones and being a world famous iconic pop star, she could live with that. But I think, you know, the way she was treated was disgraceful. She says, you know, in those days, if the press aren't writing about you and if people aren't buying your records, you know, you've essentially vanished. That wouldn't happen today because I don't think it could happen today because of social media.
For many, O'Connor became invisible. For others, a punchline. For others, the enemy. But as she states in her memoir and in Ferguson's documentary, Nothing Compares, she has no regrets about the SNL scandal. If anything, it may have saved her from an even darker fate. As O'Connor writes in Rememberings, quote, "A lot of people say or think that tearing up the Pope's photo derailed my career. That's not how I feel about it. I feel that having a number one record derailed my career. And my tearing the photo put me back on the right track. After SNL, I could just be me, do what I love." And what she loves more than anything is what she's loved from the beginning, one of the few gifts her mother gave her, the music. "I've done only one holy thing in my life," she writes, "and that was sing." Katherine Ferguson fell in love with O'Connor in her early teens. She was demoralized watching the SNL backlash, and her fondness for the singer's music only grew deeper as she entered adulthood. She had the opportunity to collaborate with O'Connor on the video for her 2013 single, Fourth and Vine, and the two kept in touch. In 2018, Ferguson found herself feeling like the world had been turned quote-unquote upside down. She had witnessed the Me Too movement and the women's marches following the election of Donald Trump as U.S. president. Government investigations and cases in Ireland had revealed that hundreds of priests had abused thousands of children for decades, with much of the abuse being covered up. Investigations and allegations in America over the past decade and a half had also revealed a pattern of sexual abuse and cover-ups in a large number of dioceses across the country. Child abuse in the Catholic Church had become a global crisis. In August of 2018, and the first papal visit to Ireland in 39 years, Pope Francis publicly acknowledged the abuse of young people by clergy members and the harm it had caused to them and the Roman Catholic Church, even meeting with 8 victims of abuse. Ireland also held a referendum to legalize abortion rights. Ferguson kept thinking of O'Connor.
It just felt really absurd to me that she wasn't mentioned in these conversations at that time, you know, especially when surely she must have inspired so many of the activists in these movements. it just felt like quite an urgent story I wanted to tell, and particularly through a contemporary lens.
Ferguson decided her next project would be the documentary Nothing Compares, which would celebrate O'Connor's work and lasting impact. The film premiered on Showtime and was released in theaters in the UK and Ireland this past fall. It was met with rave reviews and won two British Independent Film Awards in December, including Best Feature Documentary and Best Debut Director. Audience reactions, too, have been overwhelmingly positive. Ferguson recalls one particular screening in Ireland.
I was sat in an audience of 500 people, all ages from 12 up to 98, and quite a quiet audience throughout the film, completely ram-packed. And when we get to that moment, the Saturday Night Live moment, and she ripped up the Pope, the entire audience just started to cheer and whoop and punch the air and shout. And it just was amazing. It was just amazing to actually see how far things have come in the place where this was all from. Just to see the reaction of the crowd was very emotional. Very emotional indeed. It was amazing.
O'Connor had been telling the truth, desperately trying to expose it, but many refused to listen.
Everybody's just thinking, oh my God, how did we treat her the way that we did? And how did we let this happen? You know, and everything that she was saying and doing was what needed to be heard. There was nobody really anywhere talking about it. It was all to come 5-10 years later. She was so ahead of her time.
Or rather, the rest of us were too late. Like many women navigating the choppy waters of the music industry in 1992, Katie Lang, Sophie B. Hawkins, Tori Amos, Madonna, O'Connor fought for her voice to be heard. And like many of those women, she was met with opposition and disdain. While so many artists, especially women, would make compromises or back down to preserve their careers, O'Connor sacrificed massive success, wealth, awards, celebrity, for what she believed in. She was determined to fight against the ugliness, cruelty, and injustice in the world. Says music journalist Ann Powers.
Sinead O'Connor has always been a political artist. She has always written topical songs, addressed racism very profoundly, confronted religious hierarchies. She has stood as a person who presents herself just as she wants to. And it's not always something that people appreciate, casual fans especially. Oh, that crazy Sinead. But you know what? It's the challenge to the norms that's so important. It's the openness and honesty about that in her music, which remains so beautiful and so deep, like so much deeper than 98% of what else is out there, that keeps me coming back to her.
In 1992, many considered Sinead O'Connor to be, at best, a hopeless attention seeker, and at worst, a threat. Now, after thousands of incidents of child abuse in the Catholic Church have come to light, after the countless racial reckonings in recent years, after the Grammys have been forced to address allegations of gender and racial bias, many consider her a prophet and a hero.
And what was fascinating to hear is that for the first time in the last decade, she's now being written into the history books in Ireland. I think she's got quite a time ahead of her in the next few years. I think it's going to be a younger demographic. We're really going to look to her and what she did as inspiration.
Ferguson points to a vibrant mural in Dublin's Temple Bar neighborhood as further evidence of O'Connor's reappraisal and legacy. It depicts the singer wearing a shawl over her head, appearing saintly and solemn. She has that same look of determination in her eyes that she had when she ripped up that photo of the Pope on Saturday Night Live all those years ago. The mural reads, "Sinead, you were right all along. We were wrong. So sorry."
And we're living in a moment now where I think we as a society, as a culture, have opened ourselves up to hearing some difficult truths, you know? Whether it's how we speak to each other on social media or what books we're reading now or what movies we want to see. That's there, and I want to hear more of that in popular music too. And I think we are hearing it, but Sinead has given us a legacy and a guide to how to do that. Don't only think of her as the that crazy woman who did some crazy things recognize the truth she offers us.
Where Were You in 92 was a production of iHeartRadio. The executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog. The show is researched, written, and hosted by me, Jason Lanfier, with editing and sound design by Michael Alder June. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.